This is the University of Cambridge Local Examination Syndicate, International General Certificate of Secondary Education, June 2002 examination in English as a Second Language. Paper 4. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, center number, and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you are doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the tape back on. Now you are all ready, here is the test. Look at the questions for part 1. There are 6 questions in this part of the exam. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each item twice. Part 1. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. There are problems for drivers on the motorway. How can motorists finish their journeys?
We cut into this broadcast to bring you some urgent traffic news. There is a 20-mile-long traffic jam on the M234 between junctions 5 and 8. It's blocked in both directions and all entry roads are shut. Motorists are advised to leave the motorway before this stretch and to follow an alternative route to their destinations. We cut into this broadcast to bring you some urgent traffic news. There is a 20-mile-long traffic jam on the M234 between junctions 5 and 8. It's blocked in both directions and all entry roads are shut. Motorists are advised to leave the motorway before this stretch and to follow an alternative route to their destinations.
Question 2. What details does Mary give about the special offer on shirts?
The clothes shop at the top of the hill in the High Street is having a clearance sale.
That's great news, Mary. Any bargains?
Yes. Cotton shirts for 2 for the price of 1. The clothes shop at the top of the hill in the High Street is having a clearance sale.
That's great news, Mary. Any bargains?
Yes. Cotton shirts for 2 for the price of 1.
Question 3. Indira and Ashok plan to use a discount offer in order to visit a theme park. When exactly could they make their visit?
Look at this advertisement. 20% discount off student entry to Magic World.
Excellent. When can we go?
The park is shut on Mondays, and this offer is not valid at weekends or before midday. Look at this advertisement. 20% discount off student entry to Magic World.
Excellent. When can we go?
The park is shut on Mondays, and this offer is not valid at weekends or before midday.
Question 4. Mustafa and Ahmed are arranging a game of tennis. Where exactly are the courts situated?
Hi. I'll book us a tennis court at the leisure centre for 7 o'clock.
Don't worry, Mustafa. It's floodlit.
How do I find the courts?
Walk in through the main entrance of the leisure centre, follow the path round behind the swimming pool building, and you'll see the courts lit up next to the gymnasium. Hi. I'll book us a tennis court at the leisure centre for 7 o'clock. Don't worry, Mustafa. It's floodlit.
How do I find the courts?
Walk in through the main entrance of the leisure centre, follow the path round behind the swimming pool building, and you'll see the courts lit up next to the gymnasium.
Question 5. Emmeline's car has run out of diesel. How long does she need to wait to refuel?
Hello, are you out of diesel at this garage?
Yes, I'm sorry. We're expecting a fuel delivery shortly. The fuel pumps should be back in use in 3/4 of an hour.
Hello, are you out of diesel at this garage?
Yes, I'm sorry. We're expecting a fuel delivery shortly. The fuel pumps should be back in use in 3/4 of an hour.
Question 6. When and how can you obtain tickets for the cricket match?
Welcome to the cricket ticket line. There are just a few tickets left for the final match in the current series. Customers are advised to queue on the morning of the match, as tickets are not pre-bookable at this late stage. Welcome to the cricket ticket line. There are just a few tickets left for the final match in the current series. Customers are advised to queue on the morning of the match, as tickets are not pre-bookable at this late stage.
That is the last question in part one. In a moment, you will hear part two. Now look at the questions for part two, exercise one. Part 2. Part 2, Exercise 1. Question 7. Listen to the following interview with Nicola Brand, an international surfer, and then fill in the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Here on Sports Report, we're always keen to hear about new and popular sports. Surfing has been in the news headlines a lot recently. We know that surfing is becoming popular all over the world, and it certainly looks good, riding on top of a wave. Nicola Brand, you're an international surfer. Is it as easy as it looks?
No, you need to be quite brave, and a strong swimmer too.
Why is the sport called surfing?
Because you ride on the white bubbles on the crashing wave, the surf. You can surf across the top of a wave or ride through a wave as it curls over.
When did you learn to surf?
When I was 9 years old. We lived by the beach and I borrowed a surfboard from a friend and taught myself.
What equipment do you need?
Just the board. A long surfboard is the easiest one to learn on. Oh, and a wetsuit helps if you're going to be in the water for a long time.
What advice would you give to beginner surfers?
Well, firstly, look at the area in which you want to surf. Look out for any rocks or jetties and check there's no flag flying, which means it's too dangerous to swim or surf there. Don't forget your sun cream. Do a few exercises to warm up your muscles.
Okay. What next?
Well, this sounds strange, but before you learn to stay on the surfboard, you must learn how to fall off safely. You need to be able to collapse on top of your board, not to go head first over the top of it.
That could be dangerous, couldn't it?
Yes, you could easily be knocked unconscious.
Once you can fall safely...
learn to stand up on the board. Lie on it, elbows bent, back arched. Now jump, swing your legs out from underneath you and land with your knees bent and your arms held out for balance. Easy.
So, now the beginner swims out and puts this all into practice?
Yes, the trick is to paddle furiously towards the shore as a wave is growing, then to catch it as it breaks.
Is it a good idea to take surfing lessons?
Oh, yes. You could contact the Surfing Association. Look at their website at www.surf.com for information about your nearest surf school. Happy surfing.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Here on Sports Report, we're always keen to hear about new and popular sports. Surfing has been in the news headlines a lot recently. We know that surfing is becoming popular all over the world, and it certainly looks good riding on top of a wave. Nicola Brand, you're an international surfer. Is it as easy as it looks?
No, you need to be quite brave, and a strong swimmer too.
Why is the sport called surfing?
Because you ride on the white bubbles on the crashing wave, the surf. You can surf across the top of a wave, or ride through a wave as it curls over.
When did you learn to surf?
When I was 9 years old. We lived by the beach, and I borrowed a surfboard from a friend and taught myself.
What equipment do you need?
Just the board. A long surfboard is the easiest one to learn on. Oh, and a wetsuit helps if you're going to be in the water for a long time.
What advice would you give to beginner surfers?
Well, firstly, look at the area in which you want to surf. Look out for any rocks or jetties, and check there's no flag flying, which means it's too dangerous to swim or surf there. Don't forget your sun cream. Do a few exercises to warm up your muscles.
Okay. What next?
Well, this sounds strange, but before you learn to stay on the surfboard, you must learn how to fall off safely. You need to be able to collapse on top of your board, not to go head first over the top of it.
That could be dangerous, couldn't it?
Yes. You could easily be knocked unconscious.
Once you can fall safely...
Learn to stand up on the board. Lie on it, elbows bent, back arched. Now jump, swing your legs out from underneath you and land with your knees bent and your arms held out for balance. Easy.
So, now the beginner swims out and puts this all into practice?
Yes, the trick is to paddle furiously towards the shore as a wave is growing, then to catch it as it breaks.
Is it a good idea to take surfing lessons?
Oh, yes. You could contact the Surfing Association. Look at their website at www.surf.com for information about your nearest surf school. Happy surfing.
That is the end of Part 2, Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Part 2, Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 2, Exercise 2, Question 8. Listen to the following interview and then fill in the details below. The interview is about a parachute jump using a pyramid-shaped parachute. You will hear the interview twice.
Good evening and welcome to our special parachute report. We're all quite familiar with conventional parachute jumping, but here with us is the first person in the world to make a jump using a pyramid-shaped parachute. Ben Smith, what is even more remarkable is that this parachute was designed 515 years ago by Leonardo da Vinci.
Yes, Leonardo da Vinci is famous for his art, the Mona Lisa, of course, but this great man was also a scientist, architect, anatomist, and engineer. Do you realize that he's credited with being the inspiration behind the modern helicopter, army tank, telescope, and wetsuit?
No, I had no idea. Tell me about Leonardo's parachute, then.
In his day, a parachute was designed for escape, from a high tower, for example. Leonardo's drawing is of a pyramid-shaped parachute with a person underneath it. It looked perfectly feasible to me, although plenty of people advised me otherwise, so I built a full-sized model of the parachute.
What did you use to make the parachute?
Wooden poles, cotton fabric, and ropes. We used authentic materials that would have been available in the late 1400s. The parachute measures 8 meters square and weighs 90 kilograms. That's 40 times more than a normal parachute.
How did you know it would work?
That was the problem. I didn't. Would it get me safely to the ground, or would it drop like a stone? Parachute designers, balloonists, and pilots all told me it would not work.
What a risk. Could no one help you?
Yes. A university professor carried out computer simulations which indicated that the pyramid-shaped parachute might fly safely. So...
You decided to try. Where did you go for the jump?
The most suitable jump conditions were to be found in South Africa.
Did you just jump out of a plane, like normal parachute jumpers do?
No, the parachute was too large and heavy for that, and it wouldn't fold up. I was hoisted up into the sky by a hot air balloon above a national park. When we got to 3,000 metres, they cut me free.
Easy.
Yes, but then came the crunch. It wobbled a bit, and then everything was fine, and I coasted down beautifully.
Right to the ground?
No, because I didn't want the whole 90 kilograms of this pyramid parachute landing on my head. So at 700 metres, I cut myself free and released a modern parachute to give me a safe landing.
So Leonardo da Vinci was right. It worked, and you must be very brave.
It took one of the greatest minds to design the pyramid-shaped parachute, but it took 500 years to try it out.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Good evening and welcome to our special parachute report. We're all quite familiar with conventional parachute jumping, but here with us is the first person in the world to make a jump using a pyramid-shaped parachute. Ben Smith, what is even more remarkable is that this parachute was designed 515 years ago by Leonardo da Vinci.
Yes, Leonardo da Vinci is famous for his art, the Mona Lisa, of course, but this great man was also a scientist, architect, anatomist, and engineer. Do you realize that he's credited with being the inspiration behind the modern helicopter, army tank, telescope, and wetsuit?
No, I had no idea. Tell me about Leonardo's parachute, then.
In his day, a parachute was designed for escape, from a high tower, for example. Leonardo's drawing is of a pyramid-shaped parachute with a person underneath it. It looked perfectly feasible to me, although plenty of people advised me otherwise, so I built a full-sized model of the parachute.
What did you use to make the parachute?
Wooden poles, cotton fabric, and ropes. We used authentic materials that would have been available in the late 1400s. The parachute measures 8 meters square and weighs 90 kilograms. That's 40 times more than a normal parachute.
How did you know it would work?
That was the problem. I didn't. Would it get me safely to the ground, or would it drop like a stone? Parachute designers, balloonists and pilots all told me it would not work.
What a risk. Could no one help you?
Yes. A university professor carried out computer simulations which indicated that the pyramid-shaped parachute might fly safely. So...
You decided to try. Where did you go for the jump?
The most suitable jump conditions were to be found in South Africa.
Did you just jump out of a plane, like normal parachute jumpers do?
No, the parachute was too large and heavy for that, and it wouldn't fold up. I was hoisted up into the sky by a hot air balloon above a national park. When we got to 3,000 metres, they cut me free.
Easy.
Yes, but then came the crunch. It wobbled a bit, and then everything was fine, and I coasted down beautifully.
Right to the ground?
No, because I didn't want the whole 90 kilograms of this pyramid parachute landing on my head. So at 700 metres, I cut myself free and released a modern parachute to give me a safe landing.
So Leonardo da Vinci was right. It worked, and you must be very brave.
It took one of the greatest minds to design the pyramid-shaped parachute, but it took 500 years to try it out.
That is the end of part two. In a moment, you will hear part three. Now look at the questions for part three, exercise one. Part 3. Part 3, Exercise 1. Question 9. Listen to the following interview about large storms called hurricanes, and then answer the questions below. You will hear the interview twice.
Reports of hurricane-force storms seem to be on the increase. So today we welcome Professor Dedalus, a tropical meteorologist from the Weather Office, who's going to explain this to us. Professor, scientists tell us that we're going to see even more hurricanes in the next two decades. Is that true?
Yes, I think so. We can map past storms. Most of them originated in the Atlantic. And this gives us advice about the storm pattern for the future.
And what are your conclusions?
Well, I'm afraid that we predict twice as many major hurricanes in the Atlantic in the years to come as we've already experienced.
Are you sure?
We've looked at all historical records of storms and also at details like sea surface temperatures, air pressure and winds. These are all important factors, you know.
Why is that?
A warm ocean means low air pressure. And then if the wind flow is constant, a storm can easily mature into a major hurricane.
Oh dear, global warming again.
Yes, that's right.
But surely in between the hurricane reports, there are quiet periods for years and years.
Certainly. It's as if there's a switch being turned on and off in the Atlantic every few decades.
How interesting.
Yes. Look at the 20th century, for example. For the first quarter of it, the Atlantic was quiet. Then for the next 45 years, major hurricanes became commonplace.
Until...
Until between 1970 and 1994, there were only two major storms recorded then, Hurricanes Hugo and Andrew. But from 1995 onwards, the switch was turned on again as sea surface temperatures rose by 0.5 degrees Celsius. There were 19 storms in 1995, and the whole area has been a nightmare ever since.
So you've told us about the conditions, but how would you actually describe a hurricane?
It's a revolving storm with a central area called the eye, which is calm. The eye is surrounded by inwardly spiraling winds and usually accompanied by lightning and rain. We weather forecasters or meteorologists categorize each storm. A Category 1 storm, for example, has a wind speed of 60 kilometers per hour. An actual hurricane is a Category 3 storm, and its speed is nearly 200 kilometers per hour. But catastrophic hurricanes sometimes reach a speed of 280 kilometers per hour. This is Category 5.
Professor, thank you very much for talking to us about hurricanes.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Reports of hurricane-force storms seem to be on the increase. So today we welcome Professor Dedalus, a tropical meteorologist from the Weather Office, who's going to explain this to us. Professor, scientists tell us that we're going to see even more hurricanes in the next 2 decades. Is that true?
Yes, I think so. We can map past storms. Most of them originated in the Atlantic. And this gives us advice about the storm pattern for the future.
And what are your conclusions?
Well, I'm afraid that we predict twice as many major hurricanes in the Atlantic in the years to come as we've already experienced.
Are you sure?
We've looked at all historical records of storms and also at details like sea surface temperatures, air pressure and winds. These are all important factors, you know.
Why is that?
A warm ocean means low air pressure. And then, if the wind flow is constant, a storm can easily mature into a major hurricane.
Oh dear, global warming again.
Yes, that's right.
But surely in between the hurricane reports, there are quiet periods for years and years.
Certainly. It's as if there's a switch being turned on and off in the Atlantic every few decades.
How interesting.
Yes. Look at the 20th century, for example. For the first quarter of it, the Atlantic was quiet. Then for the next 45 years, major hurricanes became commonplace.
Until?
Until between 1970 and 1994. There were only 2 major storms recorded then, Hurricanes Hugo and Andrew. But from 1995 onwards, the switch was turned on again as sea surface temperatures rose by 0.5 degrees Celsius. There were 19 storms in 1995, and the whole area has been a nightmare ever since.
So you've told us about the conditions, but how would you actually describe a hurricane?
It's a revolving storm with a central area called the eye, which is calm. The eye is surrounded by inwardly spiraling winds and usually accompanied by lightning and rain. We weather forecasters or meteorologists categorize each storm. A Category 1 storm, for example, has a wind speed of 60 kilometers per hour. An actual hurricane is a Category 3 storm, and its speed is nearly 200 kilometers per hour. But catastrophic hurricanes sometimes reach a speed of 280 kilometers per hour. This is Category 5.
Professor, thank you very much for talking to us about hurricanes.
That is the end of Part 3, Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 3. Exercise 2. Question 10. Listen to the following interview about genes and then answer the questions below.
Hello and welcome to Science File. In our program today, we're going to take a look at what makes us special, our genes. Genes, spelled G-E-N-E-S, of course, have been in the news a lot lately, and scientists have just announced that they know how human genes work. Our reporter, Ralph Henner, is here in the studio today, and he's going to tell us more about genes and help us understand the way they work. Ralph, can you explain what this is all about?
Well, I'll try. The question is, what makes the human race human? And what makes you different from everyone else? The answer lies in our genes. While we have many things in common, head, eyes, and so on, the way in which our genes are put together makes us unique, each one of us.
Okay, then. But what actually is a gene?
A gene is what determines things like how tall we are, the colour of our hair and eyes. We inherit these genetic characteristics from our parents when we're conceived in our mother's womb.
Where are our genes, then?
The human body is made up of 100 trillion cells. That's a very large number, a huge number.
And what have cells got to do with genes?
It's easy. Each cell contains chromosomes.
And where do we get our chromosomes from? Are they inherited too?
Yes, some from each parent.
I see. Has this anything to do with DNA?
Yes. Inside the chromosome, you find the DNA. And inside the DNA, you find genes. DNA is a molecule that looks like a twisted ladder. And each group of rungs or steps on the DNA ladder is a gene. So, that's where our genes are, inside our DNA.
Do we have lots of genes?
Oh, yes. Many thousands in each cell in our body.
That's all very difficult for us to understand. But now that scientists know about how genes work, what could be the advantage for us?
Lots of claims have been made about possible benefits, but at this stage, no one really knows. The good news is that having a sort of catalogue of our genes and knowing how they work can possibly help us to treat illnesses such as heart disease and diabetes. Where damaged genes are causing an illness, they can perhaps be mended and thereby cure what's wrong. Obviously, research is still going on.
Ralph, thank you for explaining genes to us.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hello, and welcome to Science File. In our program today, we're going to take a look at what makes us special, our genes. Genes, spelled G-E-N-E-S, of course, have been in the news a lot lately, and scientists have just announced that they know how human genes work. Our reporter, Ralph Henner, is here in the studio today. And he's going to tell us more about genes and help us understand the way they work. Ralph, can you explain what this is all about?
Well, I'll try. The question is, what makes the human race human? And what makes you different from everyone else? The answer lies in our genes. While we have many things in common, head, eyes, and so on, the way in which our genes are put together makes us unique, each one of us.
Okay, then. But what actually is a gene?
A gene is what determines things like how tall we are, the colour of our hair and eyes. We inherit these genetic characteristics from our parents when we're conceived in our mother's womb.
Where are our genes, then?
The human body is made up of 100 trillion cells. That's a very large number, a huge number.
And what have cells got to do with genes?
It's easy. Each cell contains chromosomes.
And where do we get our chromosomes from? Are they inherited too?
Yes, some from each parent.
I see. Has this anything to do with DNA?
Yes.
Inside the chromosome, you find the DNA, and inside the DNA, you find genes. DNA is a molecule that looks like a twisted ladder, and each group of rungs or steps on the DNA ladder is a gene. So, that's where our genes are, inside our DNA.
Do we have lots of genes?
Oh, yes, many thousands in each cell in our body.
That's all very difficult for us to understand. But now that scientists know about how genes work, what could be the advantage for us?
Lots of claims have been made about possible benefits, but at this stage, no one really knows. The good news is that having a sort of catalogue of our genes and knowing how they work can possibly help us to treat illnesses such as heart disease and diabetes. Where damaged genes are causing an illness, they can perhaps be mended and thereby cure what's wrong. Obviously, research is still going on.
Ralph, thank you for explaining genes to us.
That is the end of part three and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will stop the tape and collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, the tape should now be stopped and all the papers collected. Thank you, everyone.